Well, we are back on the Ribbon Cut podcast by Strata Platforms, a place where foreign direct investors, site selection consultants, and economic developers can all tune in to really learn and hear detailed stories behind the projects. One of the things we talked about last time is how many years it takes for a project to go from an idea to an actual building.
Yep.
And so this is a place to hear detailed stories and specific examples about those projects as they're coming to fruition.
Absolutely.
I'm joined by Charles Hauser, the CEO of Strata Platforms, and we have a guest today.
Yes, we do.
Mike Grella of Active Infrastructure.
Hey, Mike.
Welcome. Hello. Mike.
How are you all doing?
Wonderful. Glad
we
to have you.
Great. So I'm going to pass it over to you, Mike, to introduce yourself and let the audience know a little bit more about you and your career.
Great. It's great to be here. Mike Grella, co-founder and chief infrastructure officer for Active Infrastructure. We are a national developer of data center real estate and buildings. We've been around for a little bit less than 3 years. We own campuses in Columbus, Ohio, Northern Virginia, and Phoenix, Arizona, and are working on probably about over a dozen projects around the country right now in various stages of pre-development. So my background previous to co-founding, starting Active, had a economic development consulting firm, Grella Partnership Strategies, where advised chambers of commerce, EDOs, utilities, did a lot of utility work. Highest and best use studies, market studies, helped build websites, did SED, strategic planning, marketing, introducing EDOs and utilities to my vast network of Fortune 500 and hyperscale data center customers and clients. Prior to that, I was Associate General Counsel, Director of Economic Development and Infrastructure for Amazon and then AWS. I was there for 7 years and founded their economic development group and helped scale the fulfillment network, the first, mid, and last mile of probably 50 plus million square feet of fulfillment center, sort center, and last mile warehouse space. Then spent several years working with AWS helping scale the global data center cloud infrastructure, about $7 billion of data center projects around the world. And before that, I'd been doing site selection and economic development. So I've been in the business about 30 years.
Wow.
And yeah, I know, right? I'm like...
You don't...
You must have started when you were 15, Mike.
Oh, bless your heart. It's the try to eat clean and do yoga. That's the only thing that keeps me sane.
Good for you. Well, thank you for coming on. We appreciate you doing this.
Absolutely.
So, Mike, you mentioned Fortune 500 companies and hyperscalers. So in terms of there's been a lot of data center announcements in the news. It's something that since the market's been introducing AI, it's been for the last several years dominating the headlines. So one of the things that we think our audience would be curious about is could you share a story about a challenging project where either the company or the consulting partners just really underestimated the complexity that goes into a data center and how it's different from other facility types, especially around power and permitting? So a challenging story and what were some lessons learned?
Yeah. Well, I would say the challenging stories are ongoing, right? Mm. And there's more than one. So
they're all challenging.
They are all challenging. You know, without naming names, I will, to protect the not so innocent, I have supported projects where the community did not appreciate the value of the data center and what it brings. And so there is, I would say, a need for education and for the hyperscalers site selection consultants, developers to really engage with the community and invest the time. Mm-hmm. And where I think things go sideways are where, and again, this is both a specific example, but more generically, is you're seeing developers and folks fly in for a hearing to get their project approved and not spending time meeting the community stakeholders. Mm-hmm. And I can cite multiple projects that did not get approved because the folks that were building the data center didn't take the time to really get to know the community, the school board, chamber of commerce, local residents. And so they show up at Pitchforks for the hearing saying, I don't know anything about this company. It's being done under an anonymous project name, under NDAs, which are perfectly acceptable. But when you're not meeting with the folks that are going to be your neighbors, that are going to be the folks that are going to be building this, the people that are going to need to deal with the construction crews and the noise, and you come in and you say, hey, but it's going to produce a lot of tax revenue, it really falls on deaf ears.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, people want to feel heard. They want to know that their concerns are validated and appreciated, even if you can't address all of them. And when you have this information vacuum, and again, this I'm thinking about one specific project where the end user did not come in, or its developer did not come in, except for this final hearing, the land use hearing, to get the property rezoned from agriculture to industrial. Or they had met with one of X number of city council members. They had met with one person and there were seven or nine to meet with. Mm-hmm. It really created this unnecessary trepidation and, frankly, kind of ignorance.
A culture of, you know, a fear. There's a fear factor of the unknown.
Yeah. Hey, there's no jobs. Hey, there's it's going to be super, super loud. You know, people saying this is going to give me cancer. Folks that are the radio waves and the frequencies from the data center are going to cause all sorts of maladies that we don't understand. And, you know, at least hearing people out and then being able to share with them facts, share with them science.
Yep.
You know, I'll tell you one of the great things that we did at Amazon, and I had created this idea. It was called the Welcome Wagon, and it could be scalable or applied to data centers, is that when local community stakeholders or elected officials had trepidation about siting a warehouse in their backyard, we would actually volunteer to fly them out and visit another warehouse in another part of the country. Mm. And so we would have the mayor, the city council, or the head of planning come out, and they would visit a warehouse and they'd get to meet their peers. So the folks that were the city manager in the city where we wanted to put the facility would meet the city manager where we already had a facility up and running, the workforce development people, the neighbors, the PTA. Hey, what kind of corporate citizen was Amazon? How was the traffic during construction? How loud are these things? Are they hiring people locally? And so we kind of took a step back and said, you know, instead of you having to believe us, which you should, talk to these third-party validators that have been there and gone through the process unfettered, unfiltered, and get their honest feedback. And it was really a great program.
That's a great idea. So they sold it for you, right? I mean, it's exactly what you just said.
I didn't have to do it.
You didn't have to. That's right. They talked to
you. And by the way, it's not all roses, and I'm perfectly fine with that.
Yeah.
Every project is going to have its externalities. Yeah, there's traffic during peak season or when the diesel generators run once a month, they can you can hear them. But there's noise ordinances. There's ways to mitigate a lot of these externalities. And you really want people to have a full picture of what they can expect this to be like. Mm-hmm. And if you take the time and you're proactive, even if you can't do this quote welcome wagon and fly people out to another data center, the more time that you invest in the community on the front end, and even with folks that are adamantly opposed, and again, this isn't a data center project, but I'm probably the project I was most proud of at Amazon is I had worked on a fulfillment center project in Shakopee, Minnesota, outside of Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And there were folks that were just adamantly opposed to us being there. And so I met with the city council members and local stakeholders made a bunch of trips out there. And even the people that were opposed to the project, when it came up for a vote, they said, when these guys first came to us, they said, just no way, no how, never, not in my backyard. And then I got to know them. And while in principle, I don't love this project, I really appreciate and respect the amount of time that they dedicated to coming to the community and meeting with folks. And so you're not necessarily going to win every heart and change people's minds or even change their votes. But when you get the folks that are adamantly opposed to tame their opposition from extreme to, you know, I'm going to do everything I can to defeat this project, to I don't love it, but I can kind of hold my nose and I can see the merits of the project. That's a huge win by itself. And so the way that I measure success is getting folks to a point where they go from uneducated or unaware to sophisticated, and that they have all of the tools and the information to make a decision of whether or not they want to support a project. And usually when you get to that point, you're going to win a lot more often than you're going to lose.
So to go from uninformed to truly informed decision-making. So as long as someone has all of the facts and it's accurate information, now they're able to make an informed judgment instead of an uninformed judgment.
And we do economic and fiscal impact studies, which are extremely important for data center projects, because data centers, again, have this reputation of there's no jobs associated with them, but they create an ecosystem. So look at Columbus, Ohio, for example. So my team at Amazon worked on the site selection and the negotiations for what was the newest region that AWS had in the United States in years. And we successfully put together a coalition working with several communities and state officials to really earn trust of local stakeholders and get them on board. And it was a real game changer. And it created an ecosystem where after AWS located, Google came and built a hyperscale campus. Meta came and built a hyperscale campus. QTS, CyrusOne, all the co-locators are now in Columbus. We were first, or AWS was first. Not only that, collaborations with Ohio State, collaborations with local community technical colleges. My friend Kenny McDonald with One Columbus Economic Development said, "You know, Intel's making tens of billions of dollars of investment in a chip factory." Said, in my opinion, if it weren't for the data center ecosystem that came here, Intel probably would not have seen Columbus on the map.
So that's that's a transformational type of deal for Columbus, right? I mean,
I mean, you have every hyperscaler in Columbus now, and I don't know what the number, many billion dollars of investment. And so the world sees that. And so the chip manufacturers see that. Other tech companies see that.
It's now a proven market. It's a proven and welcoming market that's actively working to build the skills and the capacity of the local community.
And you know what?
And people want to be a part of that.
And Indiana's replicating it. All four hyperscalers early Q1 2024, all four hyperscalers announced new campuses in Indiana. They passed legislation, albeit a few years after Ohio, but they're killing it over there. And there's markets around the country that you didn't think were going to be data center markets now. And you've got multi-billion dollar campuses being built in Mississippi and Louisiana and Alabama, all around the country now, that you never expected to be data center markets because there's power available.
Yeah, and I think the economic developers in those states, they had to have felt left out, right? I mean, if they see what happened in Northern Virginia or Phoenix or the places that accepted data centers early on, I think they just had to come to terms that we've got to get competitive.
There's an element of FOMO, but I will say just as much, the hyperscalers are chasing and the developers are chasing where the power is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so in the primary markets, the power is pretty much tapped out in the short term, right? And so you're going to where, you know, you're looking at where are the generation sources. Great. There's a nuclear plant here. There's a coal-fired generation plant here. There's, you know, unlimited natural gas here, so we can do combined cycle turbines or fuel cells, et cetera. And so you've got very highly technical site selection and engineering teams that are mapping out where generation and transmission resources are and figuring out where they can build out these highly scalable AI training and hyperscale data center campuses around the country. So I would say that, you know, as opposed to trying to attract a Fortune 500 headquarters or advanced manufacturing facility, economic developers, certainly there's a lot of work that can be done to make your state or your region or your locality more attractive. But even if you don't, if you've got power and fiber and water and the infrastructure, they will find you.
Yeah.
They are coming for you.
Yes.
And so let's say you have power and water and fiber, but the property has not been assembled yet or the site is not truly ready. How are you working with communities or with hyperscalers to sure. get those, to identify those risks and get them mitigated?
So that is a lot of the consulting work that I've done over the last several years for utilities. I've worked with other developers, I've worked with private landowners, et cetera. Yeah, and I say this tongue in cheek, but everybody has a data center site. I don't know anyone that doesn't. Hey, I've got 100 acres and it's next to a power line. This is worth $250,000 an acre. And I'm like, what makes it a data center site? And they're like, well, there's a power line over there. And I'm like, well, it's a 69 kV line and you're not going to be able to serve a data center. Yeah. Or it's a 138 kV line, which you can tap to for 100 or 150 megawatts. But if you really wanted something, a scalable hyperscale campus, you're going to want to tap into those high voltage transmission lines, the 345s, the 500s and above, et cetera. And so, you know, understanding topo, understanding, you know, proximity to you know, resources, natural gas, potential microgrid, behind the meter generation, understanding land use and zoning, the community appetite for rezoning. There are communities that love their ag land and they don't want data centers. Mm-hmm. Look at the history of, you know, farmers that have had this property for generations and they just don't want to sell. Okay, well, if the price is right, maybe they will, but some of them won't. Are you next to a rail line? Are you next to an airport? Are you next to a munitions factory where there's going to be a lot of vibrations and other types of risks? And so not that risks can't be mitigated or addressed, but you really need somebody to come in and take both a holistic high-level view of, do you have the infrastructure? What are the risks? Does this make sense? Is this a scalable data center campus? And you know, what are the opportunities? What is the cost? And what makes your site unique? Okay, you've got 150 acres and you're next to a power line and so are 10 other sites. So what makes your site more valuable? And that's where you have the consulting come in and do these technical studies, to do the geotechnical studies, the floodplain analysis, cultural resources, you name it. There's a team of civil engineers and design and other types of engineers. And then you do test fits and you put buildings down and say, okay, I could do three buildings or six buildings. And you work with the utility on, you know, a plan to serve and a load study, et cetera. But we're at a point now where utilities are not accepting applications from landowners or anyone if they can't prove their ability to transact. Now, they have an obligation to serve.
Does that mean? I was thinking when you were talking about that, Mike, we've got this tension here of you've got state economic development organizations that want to get high priority sites ready, but they also have utility providers that may not have capacity. So you're probably getting ready to talk about how to marry that up. How are they implementing a higher bar to hurdle to even become a qualified data center operator?
Yeah. So what the utilities, for example, Oncor has in their survey or their application, what level of site control do you have? Do you own the site? Do you have a contract on the site? Do you have a letter of intent, or what's your level of control or ownership? Mm-hmm. And there's other utilities around the country that are doing the same thing. They want to know, are they transacting with a counterparty that's capable of transacting? Is this a land speculator where they're submitting a load study on land that they don't even have an LOI on? And I've seen that, you've seen that around the country as well, where they come back and they give them a load study only to find out that it was a speculator that wanted to find out if a site had power. And then they go in and try to get buy the site on the cheap, mm-hmm. from a farmer that doesn't know any better, which mm-hmm. is just, it's bad business. It's frankly questionably unethical. Mm-hmm. And, you know, utilities, they have an obligation to serve, but they also don't want to waste the precious time and resources on projects that aren't viable. And, you know, Susan, at the UADA conference, you know, you heard from the utilities that, you know, they're being bombarded with hundreds and thousands of requests, but the staff is not scaling with it.
Yeah.
You know, the utility economic development groups and the folks that are doing these load studies, they're the same size that they were 3 or 4 years ago, or maybe they've hired one or two people, but they're getting 20-fold of these requests. And so something's got to give here.
Was that one of the questions you asked during your presentation, Mike? Yeah, that was one of the major insights, as he said, hey, who has received 10, 20x the amount of project inquiries? Everyone raised their hand.
Yeah.
Who has had recent staff additions? Maybe one or two people raised their
yeah.
hand.
Yeah.
So it's a tsunami of projects coming at the same staff. And so how do they sift through and – you know, demand higher qualifications from the project owners and operators to make sure that if they're going to allocate that engineering time, that there's going to be a ready party at the other end to actually build a building and operate
it. To me, Mike, and maybe this is happening, I have no idea. It seems to me they would increase their fee for a load study to weed out the
yes.
the tire kickers versus the real guys.
Yes. So NIPSCO, $250,000. ComEd, now $1 million.
Wow.
I believe Georgia Power is they're coming out very shortly with a fee structure for their load studies. There are a lot of investor-owned utilities that still don't charge for their load studies. And, you know, I'm not saying they should or they shouldn't, but certainly, you know, what I recommended was, if you charge $500 for a load study, you'd probably lose half of the applications.
Yeah.
If there's any barrier to entry,
yeah,
at all.
Any dollars.
Anything.
Yeah.
Anything, right? And so you want to be open to folks that, you know, have a viable project, but I would question somebody if they don't have a couple $1,000s. And how serious they are.
Of course.
So how are you going to have yeah. the balance sheet? If you're familiar with the CIAC, which is a construction and contribution in aid of construction. Mm-hmm. So before the utility agrees to start ordering the long lead time equipment for substation construction, switch gear, transformers, et cetera, they're going to want money from you, from the end user, from the developer, from the hyperscaler to start ordering that equipment. And so if you can't pay a $5,000, $20,000 application fee, how are you going to pay a $2 million CIAC payment?
Yeah.
So you're right. That's a good, that I think is an appropriate barrier entry. Now that said, $1 million or $250,000, there's probably a sweet spot there.
That's quite a big jump from 500 to a million.
Well, let me add just a little bit of color to the fees associated with it. If you were to tell me we have capacity in this area, we don't know exactly how we're going to engineer a solution, but we've got capacity, we've got generation resources, pay me $250,000, but we will be able to get you the power within 5 years, but we're going to tell you how. Mm-hmm. I can live with that. If a utility says, I need you to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars, and I might come back to you and tell you that I can't serve your project, I think that's a really tough pill to swallow for anybody, including a hyperscaler with, you know, very large budgets. It just, it'd be, The best analogy I could come up with is if you went to a car dealership to buy a Mercedes and you said, here's $100,000. And they said, well, we can't promise you a car.
Yeah.
But give me $100,000 and I'll come back to you whether or not I can get you a car.
Yeah. Or I'm going to keep your $100,000 and you're going to get your car in 2 years.
Yeah, we're 10 years. Yeah,
I'd be happy with that, actually.
Yeah.
As long as I knew it was coming.
I guess. It sounds like the
well, if I knew I could sell that car for $5 million, mm-hmm. if I needed 2 years, then yes.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like work is plentiful right now for you. Is that accurate? There's got to be a lot of stuff going on.
There's a lot more activity than there's ever been. And if you talk to folks that are really in the know from a kind of going up the food chain of what's driving demand, which artificial intelligence and machine learning, you don't see it in your life in an everyday basis. And so think about the demand right now versus, AI and machine learning applications. At some point, we are going to have chips in our body that are going to tell you 3 years before you might be diagnosed with cancer or have a heart attack or some other malady. And the amount of compute power that's required from a medical perspective to constantly monitor people's health is unfathomable. Now, take that and multiply that by hundreds of millions and billions of people.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying that your opinion from what you're hearing is we're just at the very beginning of larger demand?
Wow.
Yeah. Yes. In your house, you're not using AI or machine learning in your house. You might have a Ring doorbell. You've got mm-hmm. Alexa, et cetera. But we haven't even, hit the, I would say hit our stride in terms of what smart homes look like. Mm-hmm. You've got your Waze, you've got even autonomous vehicles. You see the Waymos and the Teslas. That's just a very, very small percentage of automobiles that are on the road. Think about 10, 15 years from now when that's being done at scale.
So if we're talking about that size of demand, then that's making me think about independent power producers, right? So utilities that are generating and transmitting, it's going to take too long at some point to go through. There's going to be sites that need to get opened up that are essentially on-site power generators.
That's right.
And we're seeing that now in it's infrequent, and so it's notable. But are you thinking that we're going to see that at scale?
100%. Behind the meter, microgrids and power – that is, either not connected to the grid or parallel to the grid is really that stopgap and perhaps long-term solution for power. And where you're going to find that is wherever you've got natural gas. And yeah. So we've got, I don't want to say an unlimited supply, but I speak to a lot of gas utility contacts. I've probably spoken with 7 or 8 in the last 2 weeks with different gas companies. There is a huge supply of gas. It's really just a matter of tapping into it. Mm-hmm. And so being able to convert that gas into electricity is really the holy grail as we wait for, whether it be green hydrogen, which I think is years away, but small nuclear reactors. I say big nuclear reactors. build a 10-gigawatt nuclear plant. SMRs, I can't speak to when they're going to be available at scale. It's beyond my expertise, but I would say if you've got community opposition to siting a data center that mm-hmm. doesn't have traffic, that's generally not that noisy compared to a smokestack, how are people going to react when somebody says, I want to put a nuclear reactor in your backyard?
Yeah.
I think people are going to be out with pitchforks. Yeah. And so what you're probably going to see, and again, this is my crystal ball, which is probably very foggy right now, is that you're going to see SMRs in rural areas and areas that are not primary markets first, as it's going to be, I think, a tough sell to socialize people. In the same way that if you wanted, we could have autonomous planes today that don't have a pilot, but I wouldn't ride for free on a plane that didn't have a pilot on it. Mm-hmm. But frankly, planes are pretty much flying themselves these days. It's that comfort level.
Oh, yeah.
We're just not socialized, I think, or ready for people to have nuclear reactors in their backyard. So for now, the microgrids that you're going to see popping up generally are going to be, you know, driven by, you know, gas fire generation, either, you know, fuel cells or turbines.
Yeah, we've got two, being in South Carolina, we have two nuclear reactors in the middle of the state that are just sitting there, right? And they've got to be finished. And, you know, AWS, bought the Three Mile Island, the old Three Mile Island facility. I just saw yesterday where Meta cut a big deal with Constellation Energy to buy, I think, a gigawatt of power from them over a 20-year period. It's going to be interesting to see if the hyperscalers start, you know, can they come in here and buy these two nuclear reactors and start, you know, having their own nuclear shops. It's just amazing to me to see what's going on in that industry.
Yeah, I think what you're also going to see, if you want to know who the busiest people at the hyperscalers are, it's their government relations and public policy team. It's the general counsel's office and their attorneys that are working through the super complicated power issues. It's the lobbyists and the government affairs folks that are trying to advocate for, you know, access to large blocks of power.
So, Mike, what I'm hearing, you mentioned that, so we've got nuclear that's out there on the horizon, and there's, I think people call it patient capital that's working on those types of projects. And then you mentioned natural gas and that being one of the surefire ways to be able to bring electricity to places that may not have the capacity now. And natural gas can bring manufacturing projects also. So if I'm an economic developer and I want to put my money to work to improve my infrastructure and my community, I'm hearing continue the focus on natural gas because it's going to open up either manufacturing or data centers. And I know that there are natural gas project developers out there that will work with communities to expand their distribution. So would you agree with that type of approach for a regional or a local economic developer?
You nailed it, Susan. I'm working on a natural gas line extension project for a very large transaction right now. And the CEO of the Economic Development Corporation said, I've got a very large manufacturer that wants to do a $200 million expansion, and they can't do it unless the natural gas lines are expanded for them to be able to do on-site generation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, our ability to get those gas lines extended will not only help our project, but will help this manufacturing project come to fruition. And so it really will require, a coalition of the willing of the gas company, economic developers, you know, regulators. We have to go through the process to get, you know, easements and right-of-ways and all that stuff. So you're going to have the municipalities involved and having to work collaboratively and constructively with neighbors and landowners, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But these projects are multi-$100 million investments to extend gas lines miles, but they can produce many billions of dollars in economic output and thousands of jobs and unlock primary data center markets that are currently highly constrained due to a lack of capacity on transmission lines or a lack of generation resources. So,
exactly. And it's proven and it's doable. And, you know, if you go back 10 or 15 years ago, if you're a natural gas turbine manufacturer like we have here in Greenville, South Carolina, you know, they're looking at international markets. Mm-hmm. They probably have plenty to do here domestically or in North America as these data center operators need more and more markets to operate in.
That's correct. And shout out, I want to do a project in South Carolina. So I want to work with Santee Cooper or Duke to make that happen.
Okay.
So
I'm sure they would like to talk to you.
I'm sure we will have some folks from Duke or Santee Cooper that will listen to this. So
that'd be great. I spent my last 2 weekends in Charleston and drove through Greenville. So
That's why you want to come to South Carolina. I get that.
No, I love Greenville. I went to a Consulting Connect event in Greenville last year, and it, actually, no, earlier this year. And Greenville's probably the top three places where I'd want to retire. I love it there.
Yep. It's a good place.
So let's get more data centers in South Carolina.
Well, it sounds like your data center pipeline is full, Mike, and that's That's what I'm hearing from you today, which is good for if you're a data center developer or a data center site selector, business is going to be good for quite some time. That's what I'm hearing from you, which is fantastic. I think the economic developers that are sitting on a site with ready for power or has a lot of power, I have a feeling they're going to be contacted if they haven't already been contacted by one of the four hyperscalers, which is fantastic. I mean, it's generating tax base, it's generation of jobs, and so things are moving that way whether we want to or not, right? So
I tell people, if you don't want data centers, just stop using your iPhone. Don't use your ATM card. Don't go on Instagram or Facebook. Don't drive your car. Don't use GPS. Don't watch Netflix. don't go to the doctor. Don't turn the lights on. Don't do anything.
Yeah.
And you'll be fine. And we won't need any more data centers. Don't watch a podcast. God forbid.
Yeah. Well, Mike, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it, and we look to see you on the road sometime.
I look forward to it, and thanks for having me, and I'm very excited about the future of data centers, and will always make myself available.
Thank you very much.